thank you for the introduction. Thanks, Philip and Lucian, for inviting me here. So yes, I'm from Oxford. I'm basically computer science department. So we've got a bit of a growing group there now, which has a strong interest in foundations of physics. So these are the people. So it's actually an old picture because there's some more now. But for some reason, one guy turned red when I put on the picture here. I don't know why.
Do you know which person in the group that corresponds to?
This one?
Yeah.
I know. Because Oxford is just a whole graveyard, so, you know. You know how many dead people there's. This is like at the end of St. Giles. Yeah. Right, so with such a big group, you have to sort of adopt a strict discipline. It's also in the Oxford tradition. Eh? So we have strict dress code in the group. Right, so now a bit more serious. So basically what I'm going to talk about is not how to recover the Hilbert space model of quantum mechanics like most people do here. What I want to talk about is within some what I call a pre-operational framework, because operationalism seems to have a very clear significance, what extra structure is needed to predict quantum phenomena. And so it's a very different question than saying, I want to recover Hilbert space. It's a different ballgame, I would say. And here by structure, I don't really mean necessarily the mathematical concept, but I mean something like a physical capability. This is some tradition in mathematics where like in category theory, structure really means like something new, like a new structure alone that you give, like a little building block with which you can do things. And in a physical context, you want to think of this like physical capability, like some capability nature has provided you with to do things. So it's a concrete thing. So far in what we've achieved in this approach is that everything is based on interaction between systems, which formally refer, of course, to the tensor product in Hilbert spaces. And everything we express is entirely expressed in terms of how systems interact. Like in mathematical terms, in Hilbert spaces, would be everything is expressed in terms of a tensor product and a tensor product only, without saying that it's a tensor product, basically. It's about saying what a tensor product is about, without really mathematically specifying it concretely. And this is completely orthogonal to quantum logic. So we saw in a lot of pre-construction talks here that, and the remark was made, I think, by Alex this morning, that the big contrast with, say, the previous generation is that there was zero reference to compound systems. People just tried to reconstruct systems as a monolithic entity in terms of their behaviors on their measurement. Now we see, like, for example, in Lucian's is k equals n square axiom, and this and then so local tomography axioms, this and then Matarianian's like compound system axioms, Alex had one, sort of the new thing. Everybody seems to feel that you need to bring something in of that kind. So we are radical in that perspective. We just take only compound systems. We don't really care too much about the individual properties. So once you've achieved that, then rather than saying, did we reach Hilbert space, the question you ask is, what sort of concrete models are achievable? So what sort of models can we use to model this sort of phenomena, this sort of theories? So basically, just to be met, this will be a categorical scheme, and I'll explain how this goes, and then you can ask categories of what? Categories of which spaces enable us to model these things? So basically, the first part you could see which, now a bit more concretely, Hilbert space ingredients are actually essential for quantum mechanics. So you want to pick out these little bits of the Hilbert space structure which are relevant, and then which other theories, I could see for category, do the same too. So we first try to identify what is essential in the Hilbert space structure, and then we try to see which other things do this too. Like having a more flexible structure, of course, ultimately you have to drop this word. It might be useful to build some theory of quantum gravity or whatever. And in this specific talk, what I'm going to focus on is in this sort of philosophy of like first seeing what structures are essential, what bits of structure are essential for quantum mechanics, like I'm going to contrast two possible models. One model is the Hilbert space model, and the other model is a model nothing but sets and relations. How far can we get with that if we sort of mold it in the appropriate way? That's sort of what I'm going to show in this talk, just to have some concrete illustration of this idea of playing with different models. Right. Well, yeah, but that's set theory thinking. Like, if you really think relationally and in terms of the Poisson system, it doesn't work like that. Because these are actually, you're now analyzing the Hilbert space structure of a single Hilbert space. It's exactly what I don't want to do. Okay. I want to see how they interact. And a simple example there, for example, if you say sets and relations, well, if you look at how sets and relations interact versus how sets and functions interact, these are completely different worlds. For example, the sets and relation will be very close to Hilbert space, while sets and function has nothing to do with Hilbert space, although it's both sets. So that's like a simple example which exposes that's all about the interaction and not about the internal structure of things. Right. So the good thing of being a computer science department is that you can say that you're doing foundations. Our group is called the foundations group in the broader sense, and within that group we have a quantum group. And for some reason, if you say foundations in computer science in Europe, you're really the coolest bunch, and they give you all the money. And, which is very funny, so all this stuff is not just philosophy. We actually have a product. You say these guys upstairs, they like this word, product. We have software which sort of implements this categorical structure which we use and which does automated quantum reasoning. There's a bunch of guys working on that. You can actually download it. It's called Quantumatic. And that's to keep the funding bodies happy. So what is the sort of mathematics we use as this pre-operational framework I'm talking about? It's pre-operational, and it doesn't just apply to physics at all. It applies to a lot of stuff. Like Lucian, probably tomorrow morning, is going to give a very similar story than what I'm doing here, although this is more entered to physics in this context. So let A be a raw potato. So it admits many states. It can be dirty, it can be clean, it can be skinned. And so we want to process A into a cooked potato B. So also B admits many states, like boiled, fried, deep fried, baked with skin, baked without skin. And then we consider the processes which take this raw potato A to the cooked potato B, and this could be, well, I said boiling or frying or baking. These are different processes which take raw potato A into cooked potato B, and I give them and I denote them like that, a process, like by a little arrow. And actually, state, what I already introduced there as a word, is also some kind of process. You just don't say where. So if I say here is a cooked potato, and you know it's a potato which to which it doesn't really care what you start with. Even if I say potato, then you know it came from somewhere, from some farmer, but I'm not going to tell you which farm it came from. It's sort of the preparation procedure. And so where it came from is sort of unspecified. So of a state, I think, about the state, I think of as a process from unspecified to the type of system you get. So then, of course, we can compose. So I'm using this color code here. Just let me explain that. So systems, types of systems are in blue. Their states are in red, as are processes, because states are processes. And then sort of connect, like what you would say, connectives, but in this case, this will be only composition of processes, will be in green. You probably don't see it very well, but anyway, I don't think any confusion can arise. So we think of for example, we could have a process which means doing nothing, which has this special property that if you compose it with any other process on the left and the right, you get the thing itself. So obviously, sometimes you want to consider two systems. You want to produce a dish. So let A circle with a cross D be potato A and carrot D. Just the ability to have two. You see, I'm using this symbol circle cross there, which I'm not going to call anything else. But it just means here they are both. So I can do things of them. I could, for example, boil the potato while I fry the carrot. But I could also mesh them. And so now here there is a green thingy on the left, but there's no green thingy on the right anymore. So the total process from my raw ingredients to carrot potato match is something like this, which I can write down. Like you see, I just compose all these things which I have. So there's two modes of composition. You already see this now. There is this doing one thing after another, and then doing thing one on this and one on that type of stuff. And a recipe is such a composition structure on processes. A recipe is a composition structure on processes. A law is something governing recipes, and it means if I do two things which have the same sort of compositional structure, the same, a different recipe, but they end up being the same overall thing, then I call this a law. So what is this law saying, which I have here? It basically says, if I boil the potato and then fry the carrot, it's the same as fry the carrot and then boil the potato. That's what this law on recipes tells me.
So are you implying some temporal structure in the process, is just a temporal?
Yeah, then it's temporal. First and then. So this expresses some sort of independence. Here I'm boiling, there I'm, and doesn't really matter the order. And actually this particular law is actually an inference of a much more general law, which looks a little bit more complicated, which you see up there. And you have to think a bit more about it. But it says, if I boil the potato and then salt the potato while I fry the carrot and then pepper the carrot, you do not fry the car, you fry the carrot. Or I boil the potato while fry the carrot and then salt the potato while pepper the carrot, those things are the same. It's a little bit harder to see, but just think about it, they are the same. Yeah? Remember this one. So this is clearly a law governing process, whatever sort of process I'm talking about. So basically what I just told you is what a monoidal category is about. So this is the data now, I just summarized this, the data in a monoidal category, and you can think of, you can think of this as physical data if you want. So you got the notion of system. Actually, I should put the colors here, but this is like stolen from a different talk. So this was the blue stuff. These are the types of systems. These are these processes. The process can go from a type of system to itself, but also can take a type of system to another type of system. If you talk in quantum mechanics here, for example, if you do a measurement, you start with a quantum system. If it's a non-destructive measurement, you end up with a quantum system together with a classical data type, your outcome reading. If it's a destructive one, it's typically only the reading you care about. And so A would be very different from B. It's a very different type. There is a notion of compound system. So just having these two together. And this. So here, that was my unspecified system, basically nothing. And then I have this temporal composition doing one thing after the other, and I have the notion of doing nothing, which behaves like an identity. And this is a symmetric monoidal category. Now, it's not the sort of definition you find in a textbook, and this is because the mathematical structure of processes is beautiful, the mathematical structure of set theory-based mathematical structure is very ugly. And so people don't realize how dirty mathematics becomes just because of, like, we take three sets, X, Y, Z. This thing actually doesn't exist in mathematics. What exists is either this one or this one. That's, if you know set theory, you know that you have to pick either of those. They're different things, and those things are not equal. They're obviously very closely related. There's one way to go from here to there, which is basically rebracketing everything. Now, just this simple, stupid fact makes, if you want to put this definition down, where A and B are not just like physical entities, like if you've got three physical entities, one, two, three here, I'm not going to put brackets between them, you know, there's three things. In mathematics, that entity doesn't exist of three things. You have to say, you've got two things, and then a third one. And you really have to specify which two you have first. And this is part just of set theory. And that turns this definition in a horrible thing. Because then you have to sort of formally account for that they are almost the same. And that's... What?
You don't have to...
Yeah, but... The thing is, if you really want to build up a category on mathematical structures and all that, it doesn't really, people have been really working on that for 40, 50 years.
I'm not disagreeing with your statement about that being ugly. I was just
puzzled. Oh, yeah. So if you want, this is, you've got an operation of composition on mathematical objects like sets. You have to compose them one after the other. You already start from an entity of things of three. You don't build them up from more primitive. And here the idea is I've got one set, two sets, three sets. I want to build them up to a triple thing. Just the basics of set theory for you to either do this or that. And then what this is called is a natural equivalence between these two concepts. So it allows you to go from one to the other. But it's not really essential. It's just a little. I'm just justifying here that if tomorrow you go to the library and you open a textbook on monoidal categories, it's going to be horrible. Whatever you're going to see, you're not going to see this. On the other hand, I posted a paper on the archive a month ago, which is called "Categories for the Practice in Physicists," not to be confused with introducing categories for the practice in physicists, which is from 3 years ago, which explains very carefully why this actually makes things so complicated. While if you think of categories of physical processes, these are very beautiful entities with nothing but this data. So that's my main message. Like, putting things in maths is not an innocent thing. So okay, now one step further. So I told you what a symmetric monoidal category is of processes and systems. These things, it turns out, admit a purely diagrammatic calculus. This is a mathematical theorem. So they are the same there is two mathematical formalisms which apply to the same thing. Some axiomatic category theory definition, which I'm not going to give you. Well, I sort of added on the previous slide. And some kind of graphical calculus, which I'll tell you about. And this is not just some illustration of the math. Because there is the following theorem, that the graphical calculus for symmetric monoidal categories is such that an equational statement between expressions in symmetric monoidal categorical language holds if and only if it is derivable in the graphical calculus. Doing one or doing the other is the same thing. Mathematicians are very suspicious about it. I don't know why. They really can't see a diagrammatic proof and or accept it for some reason. Well, many do, of course, but some like the Bourbaki style people, they really don't like it. I don't know why. Anyway, so similar results hold for categories with more structured objects. Not important which one, but I'm going to talk about this today. And now, so there is this equivalence. And then the question you can ask is, do these pictures just give you a different language to say the same thing, which seems to be indicated by this theorem, or maybe they do actually something more for you? My claim is that they actually do something more. So there is more. This is not just an equivalence. This is actually turning something bad, which is the axiomatic structure, into something good, which is the picture. So I'm going to show you now why. So this is a physical. This is how I depict one of my processes from A to B, just by a box. Then I have my other connectives, which was doing G after F, or doing F while you do G. You remember? This was just from my language. And what I'm now going to, you remember I had this long cooking process, this one. So I'm going to verify what it means in the graphical language, this equation. So I start with the left-hand side. You see, I take K after H, G after F, and I put them side by side. I take F beside H, G beside K, and I put them after each other because there is a composition. So what do I get? I get a tautology. Now, if you ask your student, now, let this F, G, K, and H be linear maps. Let this thing be the tensor product. Let this be composition of linear map. This is an exercise. It's a non-trivial statement if you give this to your students. They'll have to compute a little bit to establish this equation. Well, you see in the graphical calculus, you just get it for free. So in a way, this sort of long process is for free in this diagrammatic language, while it's not in the axiomatic language, because you have to write this down. This is actually an axiom you have to put down if you write down the. This is actually the only essential axiom of symmetric monoidal category, besides something of a monoidal category, I should say, this one. It's called bifunctoriality. People call this bifunctoriality. That's a technical term. But in the graphical calculus, you don't have to care. Get it for free. Okay, let's go further. So I'm now going to sort of lay out this graphical language. This is a process which is a state, which is from nothing or unspecified to something. You see, no input means unspecified. So the, in the symbolic language, I need the symbol I. In the graphical language, I don't have a symbol for I because it stands for nothing. So I'm depicted by nothing. Sort of obvious. This is from something to nothing, like you can think of this as an effect, a state, effect. If you compose a state and an effect, you get something without an input and an output. And so what we recover here is this thing which you know, you close it down, you turn it. This thing which you know, you close it down, you turn it. This thing which you know, you close it down, you turn it. So the sort of language I've been feeding you subsumes Dirac notation. So sort of it's in there. Also notice there is number there, there is quantitative information there, and actually you can sort of produce numbers. You don't know where these numbers live. We're not even talking about fields here or anything like that. This is just, the only thing you have is a composition structure, it's a monoid. So it is very general, this notion of number which this thing can accommodate. So it's, you're not talking about anything like a field. Okay, right. So to produce probabilities, we know in quantum mechanics that if you've got two states, you have to turn one into an effect. And then you can make the inner product. So the additional primitive I'm going to ask is what we call the dagger or an adjoint. And what it does for you graphically is it flips things upside down. That's the adjoint. Yeah, well, as an adjoint, you take a linear map and it flips it upside down. So, of course, I'm not saying that this is an adjoint here, but that's what it corresponds to. So in the graphical language, we assume that if you've got a box, we can flip it upside down. That's what we assume. If you flip twice, you get the original thing again. So it's an involution.
What is the meaning of the upside down box?
It will be the adjoint in linear algebra. That's a delicate point. It's extremely powerful in quantum mechanics. It defines unitarity for you, it defines self-adjointness, it defines all that stuff. Most of the things I talk about you can probably do without. It just makes life easier. So that's conceptually the hardest part of all we do, I find. But like some people believe, like I've seen in Rob's paper, it takes this like a fundamental axiom of whatever a theory should be. Right? Like this sort of, reverse. And I've seen this, but other people stating this too. I don't know why. It's some funny thing. It's not reversibility. It's a very different thing, of course, because the adjoint doesn't reverse processes. It turns a state. So, and I know in Bohm's type of process thinking, he has this idea too. But it highly keeps on convincing me that Bohm would have very much liked this idea because for everything incoming, there is something outgoing. So if you got like. And that's sort of this duality, which is, I don't know a lot about this Bohmian process thinking, but, yeah?
Is this an actual Boston diagram, or is this an operation on diagrams?
This is an operation on diagrams.
Okay,
okay, you can internalize it if you want to, but this requires, like, to extend your underlying model category to anti-linear maps, and then you can actually internalize it if you would like to. But you're at this stage, it's an operation on diagrams, you're right. Yep, indeed.
So if you have the derivation and full evaluation, then you could relate this as they were to the end, this diagram.
It's not the same, but you're running ahead. It's not the same. It's not the same. Okay, so examples of some such theories, you take finite dimensional Hilbert spaces as your symbols, you take linear maps between them, tensor products is the way of combining, the adjoint flips things upside down. Pure quantum states, operations, and effects. Another one would be you take finite sets as your symbols, you take relations as your things in between, Cartesian products to combine your sets, relation and converse to flip them upside down. So these two possible mathematical interpretations of the pictures. So, like I said before, the question is this really closer to quantum mechanics than this? And if so, how much? We'll see. This is not important. Okay, now we're going to. So, obviously, you have to add some additional structure to what I just said to approach quantum mechanics, and we're going to introduce the notion of Bell states now. Right, so this is the symbolic in notation. This is just to show that these things do have symbolic definitions, but I'm not going to care about it. So, basically, by a Bell structure, we mean a special picture of this type with no inputs and two outputs. Just again to compare, I could write this down as some map with no inputs, two outputs, the same thing, which satisfies a certain ugly-looking axiom here. But like in these languages, you start with a system A, then you adjoin this new state with two outputs. You take the flip upside down version and apply it to these two. You let this one go out, and you state that this is equal to the identity. A line is just identity. The reason I bend this is just to make this one and this one sort of, but it's not essential. So this is an axiom. Now, you can actually make this axiom much nicer if, because it's a very special state, that rather than depict it by a triangle, you depict it itself by a little piece of bended wire, like that. It comes in here and there. You throw away the triangles, and then it's just a matter of taking a piece of wire, yanking it. Right? So this is my new, this is what I call a Pell structure. So you see, this is a, it all looks like a single wire, but this is actually the new element. This is the new structural element, which is sitting here. And this is flipped upside down version, and this is the action which it obeys. Can we prove something with this? Yes. And now we come close to what you were talking about, but it's different. So I'm defining a new concept. Given this box in the middle, I define a new box, which I just depict by flipping it 180 degrees. I rotate it 180 degrees. I shouldn't say flipping. And the internal structure of it is like I put a bit of wire here and I put a bit of wire there. So if I take such a box and I put a bit of wire here and I put a bit of wire there, they're sort of represented by just flipping it 180, rotating it 180 degrees, right? That's a new concept. I'm going to call this a transpose. Right. Now I'm going to prove something. I stick in two bits of wire there, right? So, and now I'm just representing this thing small again. So this is just rewriting what is here. Here, you see, I'm just shrinking the big one to a small one, forgetting about its internal structure. And then what I do here is I take this bit of wire and I yank it. What I do here is I take that bit of wire, I yank it, and you see the resulting thing is that I've got this box here, and I can sort of slide it across the wire, and you see it rotates 180 degrees, slide it further, rotates 180 degrees. So this is now a law which I deduced from this little yanking axiomatic structure. See, I mean, you can really treat these little bends, which are sort of postulated as a new entity, really as things, little wires across which you can slide these guys. So, is it what? Yeah, yeah, of course. Right, so this is a tautology in my language. I've got this guy here. I can slide it to the other side there, and then I yank the remaining bit of wire. If I make sure that this guy is such that if I compose him with its adjoints, I get identity, which we call unitarity usually. So you see, I flip this, and then I can throw it away. Then I introduce Ellis and Bob, and that's teleportation. Right? So just to see what you have. So here is the incoming qubit. Ellis and Bob share some entangled state. Alice performs a certain effect. Obviously, it's quantum mechanics. It's non-deterministic which one is going to happen. So there is some sort of label in here which tells you what your outcome is. And then Bob does a certain operation which is, of course, correlated to the particular one which happens here. That's the classical communication, which is necessary. And then the overall effect is that whatever incoming state you've got here ends up there. So that's teleportation. Yeah?
You're not representing
And what?
Classical teleportation is implicit here.
Yeah, it's implicit. Good comment. So I'm not representing classical communication. Mm-hmm. Right. I'm not. It's implicit, and it's not very elegant. But I'm also it would also be surprising. So if this would be the case, it means that introducing this little bit of wire would bring with it the whole classical world and the ability to talk about classical spectra, which of course is not the case. So I'm just going to this slide. So the next part will be how can we define classical spectra such that we can actually make this wire explicit. That's the next step of what you want to do. I'm just showing this slide to anticipate. Right, so... Yeah?
You said there was quantum teleportation.
Right.
I'm just wondering, at what point did your argument become quantum?
Oh, no, I'm just... No. It's not quantum. It's not quantum. These are examples. I can do this thing in Hilbert space. I can do this thing with relations. I can do this thing with a ton of other mathematical structures. It's something. It's a little bit in the spirit, like Rob says, like how can we get, what sort of things do we really get need full quantum for? What sort of things can we do with less structure actually? And here, this is something you need almost nothing for. That's the message. You need almost nothing to derive this. You can see this in relationship. For people who hear about cobordism categories, you can do that there too. So there's lots of contexts in which you can do this. This is not very demanding. This works for classical stochastic maps too, this reasoning, you know. So it doesn't require anything. Right. So there's a bunch of things you can prove at this structural level. Like, it gives you enough structure to talk about CP maps and Choi Jamblikovsky and this sort of thing. Find this in a paper by Peter Selinger. You can prove no cloning and, in particular, no broadcasting at this level. It's something we should write down and never did. But this is enough. It's sort of very interesting. It's compared to the results by Howard and Alex and some other guys. They use a convex structure to say no broadcasting. We use something completely different, but we get the same results. So it's a bit funny because they are very orthogonal structures in a way. This is a nice result I want to commend a little bit on. So this is about the sort of things you can do with this sort of mathematics. So there's a statement, FD Hilbert is complete for Dagger compact categories. What does this mean? Complete has nothing to do with the kind of completeness in foundations of physics. Complete is logical completeness. Basically, what this statement means, so before your question was, where did it become quantum? So you would assume that the previous things which I told you is not very specific about Hilbert space, because it applies to tons of other models. What this result shows actually is that there's still something very special about Hilbert with relation to Hilbert spaces of this little structure I gave you. Basically, what this guy proved is that you can prove something about Hilbert spaces, which uses the language which I just gave you, these cups and these caps, which have their interpretation in the category of Hilbert spaces, tensor product, and all these things I talked about, even only if you can prove it in diagrammatic calculus. So this is not, before I talked to you about a relation between general monoidal categories and pictures, this is a statement between the concrete category of Hilbert spaces and pictures. You can only prove it in Hilbert spaces if you can prove it in pictures. It doesn't say that Hilbert space is the only category for which this holds. It definitely is not true for relations, this one. Because you really exploit the whole, for this proof, to prove this, you exploit really the whole field of complex numbers. So it's a very interesting result, this one. No, you have no cloning for probabilities. No broadcasting is the real non-clustering one. Yeah.
So where is the non-classicality?
So basically, it's a sort of non-classicality, but no broadcasting is. You can't just divide these things in quantum and non-quantum. It's like certain theories have this. What we call quantum mechanics has all this stuff. It has no broadcasting, it has non-locality. Like here, what you see is different entities have different properties. Whatever theory of this kind already has no broadcasting. Is it quantum? I don't really exclude, I don't know, it depends what you call classical again. I don't know what I mean, I don't really know what classical means, to be honest. It's not that dichotomic, classical versus quantum, I think. It's not that dichotomic, that's what this sort of analysis teaches you, that. I'll define, what I'm going to do now is define classicality in relation to this. If I have got any theory of this type, I can define classicality in relation to it. And in the case of Hilbert spaces, this will be a way to extract classical situations out of Hilbert. We know how we do it. We look at diagonal density matrices and completely positive maps which preserve these. So that's how you can, for example, since we have, you see, CP maps and Choi and Jamblikovsky in a very gentle setting, for each setting we will be able to extract the notion of classicality. Whether it's the classicality as we know it, that's a different question. It's like this relation between a quantum theory and sort of some classical part you extract from it. There's different possibilities to do that. But, yeah? This one is very closely related, I think, to one Maro uses, which he calls fateful state or something like that. So this sort of axiom is sneaking in a lot of these axiomatic approaches. So basically, what I'll be now doing, this relation between a classical theory relative to a quantum theory is very closely related to Lucian's K equals n square axiom. It's almost like an abstract implementation of that idea. So a lot of these axioms sort of are sitting here in a very general form, which doesn't make any reference to real numbers, of course, or anything like that. Okay, so next step, I want to tell something about the classical world, because that's what I need to make this classical communication explicit. So I'm going to define a notion of observable, which for me is going to be the same thing as classical deity. Indeed, you see a lot of things will be the same in this sort of language. So for me, the sort of paradigm which we use to specify what classicality is like, we say something is classical, well, if something is classical, we can copy and delete it. Or in a way, you can actually say that this is broadcasting, but it's more easy for the argument if I just say copying. Something is classical if I can copy and delete it. Nobody has any objections, so since I've got a theory of structural capabilities, I've now have to throw in a little box which copies and deletes for me to specify that something is classical. Here's my box. I don't depict it as a box, I depict it as a dot with one input and two outputs. It copies. This is a dot with one input, no outputs, it deletes. This is my copying and deleting structure. So when we were first, so basically the motivation to introduce this structure initially was really to make this diagram of teleportation get an additional wire there, which really not just randomly write a wire here, but such that in the axiomatic structure there is a clear distinction between what is the quantum, what is the classical, what you want really. And then we were playing with it, and then it turned out that this is the sort of axioms we had to impose on that, on those two things. And in technical terms, it's called the commutative special Dagger-Frobenius algebra. I actually didn't know what these things were. We just reconstructed it, and then some guy told me, oh, this is this thing. Like John Bias talks all the time about these guys. He likes them. Right, so that's not very useful, I would say. Well, it's useful. But you want to say something more about these guys. Now, what is the import? So we did this, so we first introduced this just to be able to reason about quantum phenomena and classical parts of it, describe protocols and stuff, and it worked with this axiomatic structure. Then there was some smart-ass kid who said, you don't have a representation theorem. Saying, representation theorem being, if I go to the category of Hilbert spaces and I look to things which satisfy this, what do I get? So in the category of Hilbert spaces, this would be a linear map from a Hilbert space to a tensor product. And this would be a linear map from a Hilbert space to a field of complex numbers, because that's the unit relative to the tensor. And then here you've got a bunch of axioms for them. What are these linear maps? So then we were able to prove that these things satisfying this are exactly orthonormal bases. So this is a way, all this stuff up here is a way to write down what an orthonormal basis is without even mentioning the word sum or scalar or anything like that. So this is a different way to write down what an orthonormal basis is. It's fairly non-trivial, this result, but I think the non-triviality has more to do with Hilbert spaces than with that this would be weirder. Like, I'll give you some feeling about this axiom. So what does this axiom tell you? This is called co-associativity. It tells me that if I start with something and I copy it, and then I take the second copy and I copy it again, it's the same process as starting with something, copying it, and duplicating the first one. Yeah? This one tells me if I copy and I delete one, it's the same as doing nothing. Right? And here if I copy and then I swap my outputs, it doesn't really matter. This is a crucial action, for example, for this, because if you throw this away, then you actually end up with all C-star algebras instead of orthonormal bases.
What's the number thing on top of the equal sign?
Copy-paste. They appear in some paper and then I list their names. They appear in a paper which I quoted yesterday and appears tomorrow on the archive, which is a survey of all this kind of stuff for contemporary physics. Yeah?
If you want to
wait for the questions. No, I can do questions now. It's probably more, it makes more sense.
What would happen if you're
saying about
just
the vector space, no one thought? You have a similar result, which if you take, so the dagger means Hilbert space. The dagger, this adjoint structure is really something which witnesses your inner product. What? So if I don't have that, then this thing is that, but I have to tell you what that thing is. Because it's, so, but if I actually, instead of having two of these things, I've got four of them, this one and the other one, up, and so one upside down, which is now sort of independent from that, this one upside down, I write all these axioms down, I get arbitrary bases. So you can throw away some of, if I happen to throw away, for example, this one, then I get orthogonal bases, not orthonormal. Nothing here. We have no clue how things work in infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. We have no clue. The sort of operational reasoning, trying to do protocols with these works, but the representation theorem is a big open problem. Nobody knows. So I've got a student specifically working on this problem. It's very hard. It's very hard. The problem is that not this guy, but this guy upside down, typically is just the sum of your base vectors, so it degenerates. So you have to throw away, this is actually a unit. So in technical terms, if you look at this guy upside down, if you look at this guy upside down, like that, this is called an internal multiplication in a category. So you have A, you have B, and then you think what comes out is A times B, right? And then this thing is just associativity, this is commutativity, this is having units. So if I stick in something here and I get the identity means having a unit. If one puts this upside down, one calls this a co-monoid. So monoid is a group without inverses. So that's a co-group without inverses or something like that. What was I saying? I don't remember. What was the comment again? Okay, yeah. So the problem is that this unit here would diverge in infinite dimensions. And it, for some reason, it makes you lose a lot. So that's a problem. Right. So this is not very... one of the main sort of slogans I had was this diagrammatic calculus is good, but you don't want to carry around all these axioms because it's a bit horrible. It's a bit horrible, these sort of axioms. Like mathematicians, like this is very, like people who are doing topological quantum field theories, like 2D topological quantum field theories, they are commutative Frobenius algebras in Hilbert. So it's something which shows up in a lot of contexts, this sort of mathematical structure. It's not just a freaky thing which we use. So how can you play with these things diagrammatically in an elegant way? It turns out that this definition, this is the definition here. Huh? You've got two things, which satisfy a bunch of axioms, is equivalent to this definition. Now this definition looks a little bit different, but it's the same thing, believe me. So what is this definition? It says, I've got a bunch of spiders with m front legs and m back legs. Whenever two spiders meet, they shake hands in at least one hand. This has to be non-zero. Then they melt together in one spider. So you can basically, this is algebraically a crazy structure because you've got an infinite number of primitives. You've also got an infinite number of rules. But diagrammatically, it's very simple. You've got spiders running around. When they meet, they fuse. It's the same thing. You can show this. It's called the spider theorem, which relates these two. Something really funny which you see from the spider theorem, I could also show this from the previous set of axioms, is that you remember my yanking axiom? Two cups and caps, you stretch. It's subsumed by the spider reasoning. You see? Suppose I take a spider just with one front leg and one back leg. That's like this one. I take a spider with two front legs, I take a spider with two back legs. They meet in this sort of configuration, and then you see my spider law tells me that this thing yanks to this, because the number of inputs always has to match the number of outputs. Number of inputs here has to match number of inputs here, number of outputs here has to match number of outputs there. So all here, all this, I should actually put this m's equal to 1 here now. You see, this spider reasoning subsumes the yanking of rho. So and the way to think about this axiom, the way you might want to think about this axiomatically is like the first, no, not axiomatically, intuitively, is like the previous set with these wires and yanking, you could think of as a Hilbert space. So this kind of stuff, that's a Hilbert space with a specified basis. And this additional structure tells you what the basis is. So in the context, did I have a slide? Yeah, so here, for example, in the case of Hilbert spaces, it's obvious. You pick a basis, and then you define the linear map which copies this basis. Such a linear map witnesses this basis by the no-cloning theorem. Well, it's actually a bit strong, I'm saying more here than the no-cloning. But the only things which are actually copied are the basis vectors. That's what the no-cloning theorem tells you. So writing this map down is the same as writing the basis down. So what actually the theorem we proved says is that the converse is also true. Whenever you've got an algebraic structure, which now might even look like this, it will always correspond to a basis. It arises in such a way from a basis. Like the way you get this spider is just that you put n times I here and m times I there. That's how these spiders arise. And these things exist in the category of relations too, again. So there's no difference there. So yeah, this paper we recently put on the archive, and this is really about how to extract the classical world from the quantum world and build all kind of stuff like how do you build stochastic matrices, how you build classical probability theory out of such a category purely at the axiomatic level. So, right. Complementarity. Right. So what I've been talking about now. So we only have been talking about the concept of an observable on a space, because this yanking bit of in the beginning, it just was just like a little story to make you comfortable with the notation, but I just showed, where is it? I just showed that it's actually subsumed by this sort of language anyway, so we don't have to remember that. Okay, complementarity. I give a definition, so what I'm now going to try to do is define complementarity at this general level. So I say that two observables are complementary or imbiased, like people say now, if the classical states for one are unbiased for the other. So there's two concepts here which I need to define. What does it mean to be classical, and what does it mean to be unbiased? Classical is very easy. You remember, the interpretation of this thing was the thing which copies basis vectors. Basis vectors are your classical vectors. These may copy your classical context from your eigenvectors. So we define them to be things which are copied. Obvious, right? So it just follows from the intuition behind what this copying does. You see now I'm giving this a color because I'm going to use two colors for two different observables. But this is just a dot, like the dots in the spiders. Huh? This is just a normalization condition, such that you get exactly one for each observable. It's not that important. Unbiased. So this is what I define to be unbiased. Now, how does this work? I sort of told you that this thing is like a multiplication, right? So if you, and the fact that I, so that's something I didn't say. So I told you that adjoint is flipping things upside down. Transpose is rotating things 180 degrees. What do you get if you compose the transpose and the adjoint? Conjugation. So conjugation is flipping things like this. And if you compose 180 degrees, we're flipping like this, you get flipping like this. So the fact that this is pointing here and that's pointing there means these two things are conjugates. So now think in Hilbert space, so I stick in here this one, I stick in the conjugate here one. So what do you get? You get phi 1 bar. So you get a list. Here. Phi, and so this put a bar there, a bar there. Yeah, it doesn't really matter. So I've got this list of components here, and this thing, like basic in the sort of representation I gave, I didn't mention this, but the interpretation of the deleting operation, it takes every basis factor to 1, so the adjoint to that just is the sum of all the basis factors. So this equation is saying that this is equal to a list of 1s. So up to normalization, this means unbiasedness. The weights of the components relative to the bases are equal. So this is in the Hilbert space. You can give a more conceptual definition for that, but I don't want to get into that. And then, so basically I'm going to use the notation to put, you see, on the in, I'm using two colors, like whatever I put on the outside means whatever it's unbiased, whatever it's classical for, whatever I put on the inside is whatever it's unbiased for. So complementarity now we depict as something like this, like this guy is classical for green and biased for red. And this guy is classical for red and unbiased for green. And if this would be the classical points of an observable, then we would have an unbiased pair. Right? And then you can prove that in all this abstract setting that this picture actually tells you what complementarity is. You show this. This is a theorem. So it's an if and only if. Two observables, two spiders are complementary, even only if this equation holds. It's a very interesting equation. Like you see, you've got the red spider, you've got the green spider, they don't like each other. The moment they touch, their arms fall off. They're full of diseases. That's basically what it says. So I'm not going to go. So the proof is very short. So just to make a comment here. So this is like complementary observables. Comparable observables would be where these two things, for example, are the same. You get a wire. Complementary, you see there is no connection. So it really gives the intuition that if things are complementary and unbiased, there is no information flow between them. See, there's no wire, no flow. Sort of the idea which you got here. The proof is not longer than this. Okay. The question is like, how close are we coming to quantum mechanics with this sort of axiomatization? Suppose we've got a pair of complementary observables. But it turns out that we can do a computation like this. Here you see two matrices. These are two C-naught matrices. You can actually, if you take green to be the Z observable and red to be the X observable, then this little picture turns out to be exactly the C-naught gate. Now, I usually write things like this, but it turns out if I take green here and a red there, that this is the same as putting them like this. So I can as well put it straight. So I depict it like that. And so this is actually what turns out to be a C-naught gate in the case of Z and X observables. Now let's see if we compose two C-naught gates, what do we get? So we first use the spider fusing rule. Two green spider meet each other, two red spider meet each other, they fuse. Now you see this double wire configuration in the middle, which was complementarity, it goes, so we get identity. So we have much more complicated. There's a paper online which is called Interacting Quantum Observables, which gives more complicated. We actually compute quantum Fourier transform in such a matter. Right, that's what our software does. It does all these sort of crazy computations for you. I'm not getting close to whatever. So phases. It turns out that this calculus, what we're talking about now is we've got this notion of observables, and then I said we can talk about two observables that are complementary via this law, which I just gave you. It turns out that having a notion of observable already gives you a notion of phase. So a phase is defined to be just an unbiased point. You remember this definition of unbiasedness? I define a phase, relative to green observable, I define a phase to be just any unbiased point. And then you can show that these unbiased points of any observable always constitute an abelian group with conjugation. Conjugation was flipping left-right as inverse. So I'm just talking about this graphical calculi here, or this category. So you prove this in generality. And we call this group the phase group. So basically, the fact that this is defined in terms of these observables, which were equivalent to the spiders, turns out that you can actually just decorate these spiders with what we call phases. Now, which are these? Basically, you stick in an unbiased point somewhere here. That's what it means in your picture. You just stick in an unbiased point. If I stick in an unbiased point alpha here, an unbiased point beta here, then on the fused spider, you just, I call this adding, but actually, adding basically just means this sort of multiplication. So if I've got alpha and I've got beta, then this is alpha plus beta. You just multiply them like that. It's an easy consequence. Right, so just now to give a concrete example, if you start with a qubit, then these dots would look like this, so they're lying on your equator. So this is for the where I take the Z observable. So I copy 0 to 0, 0 and 1 to 1, 1. So the phases lie here. And this, such as if I then write down a spider like that, is the phase gate. And you do the same thing if you take, for example, the other observable. So this would be your phase point, and this would be your phase gate. And I don't know, think, well, basically, you can then show that this graphical language of two observables and phases is enough to write any linear map down on sequences of qubits. It's sort of rich enough. This just follows from the usual universality theorem for quantum computing. You need a CZ gate, and you need local, all local unitaries. And since we've got X and V, you can do Euler angle decomposition. So it's sort of rich enough language now. You can build really nice examples. So like I said, we have this paper online where we do a bunch of things like examples in measurement-based quantum computing and stuff like that with this language. Okay, now I'm going to what I announced was going to be the main thing of my talk, to compare these relations and Hilbert spaces. So let's talk now about relations. So you see, I'm using bracket notation to talk about relations. Why can I do this? Because I showed you that this bracket notation is just a general thing for all the symmetric monoidal categories. So anything which has this structure, I can use direct notation for. So this is basically the relation which relates 0 to the pair 0, 0, and 1 to the pair 1, 1. So it's a relation. And here is the relation which relates 1 to singleton 1, 0 to singleton 1. So this is a natural structure in the category of relations of this kind, which I called observable or basis. So we were very shocked at some point to discover that on the two-element set, it's not the only one. So it turns out that as much as you might think that sets and relations are very classical, on the two-element set, there already exists a complementary set of observables. So I'll write down what it is here. So you take 0 and you relate it both to the pair 0, 0 and the pair 1, 1. You take 1 and you relate it both to the pair 0, 1 and 1, 0. And then you've got a corresponding unit. And you can show that this thing obeys all these actions I was talking about of an observable. You can show that these two are complementary to each other. Basically, this means that in the category of relations on this two-element set, this little computation I did with CNOT gates, you can perform it there too, of course. And you can do a bunch of other stuff which involves complementary observables in the category of relations on the two-element set. It is sort of shocking, almost, that you can do that. Now, how did you come about this? We didn't discover this by looking for it. We discovered this when we were trying to turn Rob's toy model in a categorical version. And this is the mathematical core to why toy theory works, actually. That you got on the two-element set, in the category of relations. Category of relations, I don't know whether I was clear what this is. Like, your labels are sets, and the things between them are relations. And the way you combine two sets is with the Cartesian product. That's what it is. So it looks very innocent. Looks very innocent. Still, you got this complementary observable sitting there. Right. So, what actually this led us to, this observation, and then trying to axiomatize what Rob's toy theory is about in this sort of language, led us actually to an analysis of what is non-locality, where, in some structural sense, in for Hilbert spaces, non-locality comes from. And so I can stop, or I can do this. I can take questions too.
But now we have 30 minutes.
Well, I was supposed to stop after 45 minutes, according to Philip. I can't, this takes 10 minutes, I think. I can also answer questions. Okay, right. So usually, if people talk about non-locality, they say what it is not. Like, it's not locality, there's no hidden variable series, some inequality is not satisfied, some correlations cannot be obtained. So what we like in the sort of spirit which I said, we like to see which sort of structural component tells you what non-locality is. The idea is here was to see what gives you non-locality. And the sort of strategy we had is we know that Drop-Stoi theory is very close to stabilized quantum mechanics, but it's local. It seems to be as close as you get without being non-local. So maybe if we can identify the tiny difference between Stoi theory and stabilizer physics, we sort of see where non-locality really kicks in stabilized quantum mechanics. Stabilized quantum mechanics is non-local. Not if you look at Bell inequalities, but if you look at sort of GHZ state. Right, so I said GHZ state. Oh, do I have to introduce a totally new concept now? I want to talk about non-locality in the context of GHZ state, so I have to define something which is a GHZ state. How I define a GHZ state? I take a box with three outputs, and you know before, you know how everybody knows what a GHZ state is. It's like three zeros plus three ones. So if I swap the first and the second, then I get the original one too, because it's totally symmetric in three systems. If I stick in the plus here, then I get a Bell state. A Bell state, I talked to you about before what this was. So this defines Bell state. And then, so what I'm writing down actually here is I flip the thing upside down and then I transpose it. So this is the adjoint transpose. So this is the conjugate to this. So what I'm saying is, this thing is equal to its conjugate, meaning it doesn't have any phase information here. Same thing for this is just this is the plus state, sort of the unit. Now, is this a totally new concept? No, it turns out this is exactly the same thing as what I defined to be a basis. So basis and these sort of guys obeying these axioms are exactly the same thing, it turns out. And the way, so you can, all the axioms which I showed you before, or the spiders, translate to these guys. It's not important to see this. It takes a bit of work actually to see this, but just if I've got my copying operation here, I sort of put them in the box to make it clear. Then you see from two copying operations and one, I can make one of these. Similarly, if I've got a bunch of these guys, I can turn this into a copying operation. Now you can show that the actions of one exactly match the action of the other. So we don't need a new concept. That's good. GHZ state is the same as the base. Okay. GHZ, non-locality is about the kind of correlations you get in experiments, right? So here is your GHZ state. I observe an X, I observe Y. What do I get here? Well, how do I compute it? I just sort of slide these things down, and it's just actually the multiplication of these two guys. Remember, I've been talking about this multiplication thing here, which you get in your... It's just a simpler way to write this. What you see, but what I'm showing here is that all the information on the correlations is about this. If I get X and Y, what is this one? That's what correlations is about, right? I measure two, what is the third one? So everything is encoded in this operation, what correlations are about. Okay, I'm going to give you a definition. So I define a mutually unbiased theory or sub-theory of some other theory, some kind of theory in which all the states are eigens. What is this? That states are either eigenstates or unbiased states for observables. This is, for example, true for stabilized quantum mechanics, right? All states are either eigenstates or unbiased for another observable. That would be defined. And then we got the following theorem, which is sort of striking, that in any theory of this kind, which includes Drop-Stoi theory, all states are either unbiased or eigenstates for all observables. Stabilized quantum mechanics has the same property, for qubits, qubits, whatever you want, all of them. So these are all things which fit in this category, or also all the qubit, whatever second story theories, they're also in here. In mutually unbiased theories, the correlations you get for a GZ state are completely determined by the phase group. So the phase group was this entity I extracted from this copying operation. So what this says is that GZ type correlations, and actually you can show basically all correlations which you can get in such a theory, are classified by abelian groups. Abelian groups, we know what they are. So there is sort of a funny result here that you can map abelian groups on non-local behaviors. We don't know too much about that yet, but we know one very special case. The very special case of the four-element groups. Okay, so abelian groups. So now you can say, let's look at the groups of four elements, let's look at the groups of 10 elements. What sort of non-local behavior do they generate? Okay, let's look at groups of four. What is this? What is this line? I didn't do that. Anyway, so there's two abelian, irreducible abelian four element groups, which is Z4, four element cyclic group, Z2, Z2. Huh? What do they correspond to? They should correspond to some kind of non-local behavior, according to our theories. Well, it turns out that the first one is exactly qubit stabilized quantum mechanics, which we know to be non-local. The Z2 is Speck and Stoy theory. So basically, the essential difference between Speck and Stoy theory and Z and stabilized quantum mechanics is that this group of phases I was talking about is different. In stabilized quantum mechanics, it's a cyclic four-element group. In Stoy theory, it's Z2 times Z2. This fact, having a phase group in this very abstract sense, which is this four-element cyclic group, actually, which has this four-element cyclic group as a subgroup is enough. You can show. You can go through Mermin's argument and it completely carries through. So this is enough to get non-locality. This is really what does it for you. Because you saw this already before, that all these correlations are like defined by this multiplication. And this multiplication essentially boils down to what this phase group is about. So you sort of extract the difference between, I don't know whether, so I'm just to show how these things can be written down as categories, and then I'll end this like, so how do you write down stabilizer quantum physics as a category? Well, you start with the category of Hilbert spaces, which has Hilbert spaces, and then you restrict your systems to nth powers of qubits, because you're working stabilizer qubit theory. And then you say, well, my theory is going to include all the unitaries, which sort of preserve the what I call the block octahedron, it's 0, 1, plus, minus. So you have to, they should preserve these 6 points. That's what you expect. And then you adjoin one additional map, which is a map which copies one basis to your choice. It turns out if you compose all these guys, you get the whole of stabilizer quantum physics. So it's sort of generated by a notion of system, a notion of local operation, and a copying operation. Generates your whole stabilizer theory. Again, it's easy to see because I told you that from this guy together with the Hadamard, from this guy say it's the Z copying observable. You take the Hadamard gate, which gives you the X back. You combine them, you get C naught, and so on. From there, you build everything. This is now correspondingly how this looks very different than Rob's presentation of the same thing, but it's the same thing. You take the category of all relations, and now you restrict it to powers of four-element set. This will be your elementary system. Your operations are all permutations on the four-element set. These are actually both as groups isomorphic to S4. Both this and this is S4. So although it's defined differently, it's the same group of local unitaries. And then you take some copying operation. So this might not be evidently a copying operation, but you remember I told you that there was two sort of these special observables on the two element set. So this is one of them, and this is also one of them. So you just make pairs of them. That's why I said this observation of the two element, on the two element set, that you have this complementary basis. If you then lift this to the four element set, you get this three pairs of complementary bases. Obviously, when I use the word complementary, I always mean in this green red dot sense, because that's the only definition that applies to something like that. And so you see they're very similar. They're generated by some elementary system, the group S4, and a copying operation, both of these theories. So where is the difference in the way this guy interacts with this guy? It's different than in the way this guy interacts with this guy. And that's actually what is encoded in this phase group structure, completely. So that's the difference between these two theories. So these are just all the complementary observables. I already said this. But anyway, I don't have to say anything more anymore. Basically, what I'm showing here is that you can, from this Z4 structure, you can basically reproduce Merman's argument and show that it's non-local. So, okay, here are some references. I put this one on yesterday, so it should be there tomorrow. Sort of a survey of all this sort of stuff. And for people who want to learn a bit of category theory, this is like an underpaid tutorial which really tries to appeal to physicists without like throwing big definitions in your. And this is the paper of the non-locality. It's not on the archive, but because it's not really finished yet, but there is some version available of it about this non-locality business. Okay, thank you.
Okay. I want to go back to the very beginnings of the talk. You have this wonderful way of introducing the structure of a monoidal category in terms of, you know, the visual characters and the data.
Okay.
And so, can I ask you how you would analyze the following scenario? You might want to write even on the board a little bit.
Exactly.
Yes. Suppose that I have the following three systems, and I want to consider them initially to be grouped together in the following way. So let's write the first one down. That's a fox. Okay. And now I want to tensor that with a chicken. Okay. And now let's bracket that whole thing.
What's the bracket?
Yeah, I just put a bracket around. Now tensor that with a farmer. And why would I say that that's the same thing as
I know,
a
dog okay.
tensor, chicken tensor, farmer?
So that what you're now doing is like introducing space-time concepts or whatever additional structure. So you're now using the brackets to give some sort of additional structure of these guys are close and these guys far away.
Not necessarily. I guess what I want to say is sometimes objects interact with one
another.
When you put them together, they do something together. And so not every possible coupling is as simple as putting two objects down in the
shape. No.
And if that's the case, it's not so obvious to me that the theory would either have just one primitive tensor product,
I see what you say. What you're doing is you're putting additional information in the tensor product, because these brackets are basically part of tensor structure. They're not just like random things, they're part of tensor structure. In the first paper we published on this, we actually use this to describe teleportation. So when you like in the teleportation diagram, like to describe this situation that, so how did it go again? So I have to write this one thing. So here, for example, the entangled state is created, so you would write this A tensor A, right? And then this A actually goes with this A, so that you can do, so here you write A tensor A. So in our first paper on this, that we actually exploited this additional structure to sort of say, now this this system is here and that system is there. It's very much the same idea as what you're doing here. Like chickens with fox and farm is not really there in the middle to separate them. But the thing is, it doesn't really work out nice. This is an idea. You can think, hey, we can use these brackets to sort of give a notion of topology. It doesn't really work out nicely when you start to get four and five systems. I know, because the nesting, this thing is not naturally nested that much. That's my feeling. So it's not the proper way to do it. If you want to introduce some causal structure, because one of the things, this is a theory of process. There is some minimal causal structure in the sense that something happens after something else, and the tensor sort of seems to indicate that things can happen independently. So it's sort of a very primitive notion of things having the potential of being spatially separated and having to do, like the picture, for example, the graphical representation of the first action I ever wrote down, do this while this, or do this while this, looks like this. So it means it doesn't really matter in which order they happen. They're independent. Whether this is further. So that sort of gives an impact. But I think the thing to do is that you want to have some function from some space-time structure in this category. It's very much the same thing as people doing that algebraic quantum field theory. But of course, you don't have to commit yourself to CSR algebra.
Can you often do the proofs? Is it, can you often do the complete diagrammatic, or is it not to actually start writing down something else and then turn the result of the diagram? Well, it depends what sort of proofs, like with this non-locality stuff,
you're talking about concrete models, so you have to go to your models to identify differences in models. Like the composition of gates and the sort of examples we do, say with cluster state computation, it's purely diagrammatic. That's the idea, that we can do everything purely diagrammatic. And the software, so basically this is actually, there is the old story of quantum logic is not a logic, like orthomodular quantum logic is not a logic. You don't have a deduction scheme, and you can't really guarantee any computational power out of this. This stuff is in a way a hyperlogic. If you sort of, and there is this discipline of categorical logic, and that's you basically can interpret a whole bunch of branches of usual logic, which you interpret in terms of Boolean algebra, in terms of categories, and it actually gives you more flexibility. There are logics which can't really be translated to Boolean or lattice, and which can be expressed in categories. And in this sort of categorical logic terms, this is like hyper-deductive. So when you yank a wire, you sort of make a super deduction. That's what it forms. I don't know if you know about Cartesian closed categories, which sort of articulate logical deduction. This is sort of bi-closed. It's closed in one direction, it's closed in another. But closure means like that you can do deduction. It's very, so you can implement this on a computer and make the computer do all that stuff for you.
Can your framework also describe traditional processes in the following sense? Process, for example, is a measurement, and then a subsequent measurement might be conditioned upon the outcome at first.
So, yeah, Rob and I will be writing a paper. No?
In your preview, what's sort of the government law?
He's asking something different. He's not asking about conditional probabilities. You're asking about sort of feed forward, when you take into account, let's say, your quantum measurement, and you have a classical algorithm, you want to feed that classical algorithm to a future quantum measurement.
Oh, sure, yeah. So I didn't show this here, but the whole point initially of introducing these observables or this Frobenius structure was exactly to that, to like have teleportation, where you got sort of a wire going out of your classical outcome and then feeding it to your correction. That's what we're talking about, control structure. Your classical outcome, so you take a classical outcome out of your measurement, and this is what you, in measurement-based type quantum computing protocols, that's, you do this all the time. You measure something, you use your outcome to control further, do a quantum operation. Yeah, so I didn't really describe, this sort of stuff is in a, okay, this paper goes very far into that sort of stuff. How you get control structure out of this classical basis structure.
So basically what flows through your wires, that's partly a broken system.
So the wires which I've shown here are essentially all quantum wires, you could say. So you have to do a bit of a trick. It's not a trick, but and this is where it's very close to sort of Lucian's n squared equals k axiom. So if you go to one of these spaces here, like which I defined, then you can build something like this. So you take this and you compose it with this. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of my talk that there is a way to construct completely positive maps and density operators. Basically, the way you do it is in your initial category, you take things which look like this. So they're a bit funny. You see, there are two inputs and two outputs. But this guy, Peter Selinger, showed that pictures like that are exactly completely positive maps. And the reason you've got two wires there is very much the same as if you write down a density matrix, then you write this. Your state is twice there. Yeah, this corresponds actually structurally with having two wires in. And then this operation applied to this thing is decoherence. This throws away all your non-diagonal elements. So that's a way to asserting that your wire is classical. And the way you then do it is, for example, so if I do this, then this single wire represents my classical system, double wire represents my quantum system. And you can then show that this is like a faithful semantics on how classical and quantum interacts. And then the way teleportation would look would be like, you've got two wires representing your quantum system, something happens here, I'm not going to give the details, one single wire comes out and goes to your correction operation. So you can really see double wire is quantum, single wire is classical. And then there is some internal structure here, which is like this.
Could you comment on the
intentional probabilities? I don't know. So basically, the way we do conditional probabilities in that paper, and the nice thing is, it's not restricted to classical Bayesian, but also that there's some versions of quantum Bayesian reasoning due to MetLife, I think, mainly. Is that if this is A condition of like A conditional log to B, then you derive B conditional log to A, the graphical calculus purely by doing a transposition. That's how it works out. And then the conditional independence, that's a beautiful one too. Conditional independence, for example, A and B are conditionally independent of C. This would be A output, the B output, the C input. Then there would be one of these dot structures which sort of splits this open in A conditioned on C and B conditioned on C. So you see the elements of the language I was talking about, this transposition structure, this Bayes law, and this conditionally independent. And the thing is, this can be quantum operations. It don't have to be like classical stochastic mass necessarily. That's it.
Well, I ask a totally absurd question. So, you start off at the very beginning with monoidal category. So you have this notion of composition. Now, I thought if you varied anything at a very fundamental level, then that would correspond to some very radical new framework. And so that occurred to me, well, take this following radical framework, where instead of having three spatial dimensions and one temporal dimension, we have two temporal dimensions. I was trying to work out whether that means you could no longer get away with a single composition operation. You couldn't just have a one notion of then. You'd have to have, then in this axis and then in that axis. So the absurd question is, could you potentially, in a categorical framework, describe a situation where you have...
Yeah, so algebraically, that shouldn't be a problem, because the idea of having two compositions means that you've got what I call a two-dimensional category. That would be a three category. And people do have graphical languages for that too. They're more likely phones. Again, this is stuff you find lots of out on John Bias's webpage. It could be developed. So for example, where such a additional dimension would show up without having to go two times would be if you instead of just looking at I redraw this picture. You saw I took a picture and I started to redraw it. But the sort of redrawing of the picture is in itself a process. Sort of it's a transformation of a certain experimental situation in another. The experimental situation has some sort of temporal content already in the way it's set up. But you transform it in another one. And that would already introduce a third dimension. So in computer science, people use these three categories really to, because they use this to describe computational configurations exactly in the same sense, the sort of transformations from one configuration to another configuration. That would already also introduce this third dimension. And this should be done at a fundamental level, I think. Or you could, So another modification is where you don't expect this. So actually, I didn't do a lot. I didn't mention symmetry, but like typically, I don't know whether I used symmetry actually. But when I say symmetric model category, I mean that there is something like this, and if I got a box here, then you can sort of step in there. That's what's called symmetric model category. There's a crossing. So things people play a lot around with is if it matters whether which of the two crossings is on top and which not. That's braiding. That gives you braiding. And people doing topological quantum computing, they're looking at model of tensor categories, which are categories of this kind. So and that's fundamentally different at the starting level. And this comes in when you want to talk about bosons and fermion statistics. Of course, then you can't just swap things. You have to be careful how you. If you again in the previous tensor part, but this is related to Alex's comment about giving some more structure to your tensor that you, for example, interpret things as being in space-time.
So here that connects to my follow-up question, which is if the formal loop distinguishes the number of temporal dimensions, why doesn't it distinguish the number of spatial dimensions? It sounds as if you add structure, it can.
Good question. In a certain sense, I assume that the number of complementary observables, in a way, could tell you something about spatial dimension if you think of the block sphere. If it would give you a three directions on the block sphere. That's all I. But it's not a big deal, I think. My fear is that when you go to really process in space time, you need to not give up on this, but you need to add something to it. Really. When I draw these pictures, I'm already assuming you saw I drew Alice and Bob, and I put a box around it. That's additional structure. So I assume that there is some sort of space which has two locations, which are far apart, and I put them into boxes. So there is this additional structure already, sort of sneaking, which is sort of through it.
I just buried my comment then previously on the archive. There's a paper on PR boxes which they're trying to wire together. I just wanted to really do in category here. They're aiming at wiring, having special sets of PR boxes with a constraint to try and get just quantum mechanics, no violation of serials and bounds. But they're doing boxes and wirings and machining.
But people draw a lot of these boxes informally, of course. Now, I'm working with somebody like trying to see what PR boxes mean in this sort of language.
For example, they don't know if a certain restriction is a symptom, you just sort of get down and sort of identify what a syntax is in a general way. I
suppose that's too specific. Yeah, I know that Howard and also Alex are a little bit looking at combining these monoidal structures with convex set structures. Okay. See how these things. There is something which is called an enriched category, and then your sort of sets of processes have an additional structure which then sort of commutes nicely with the composition, a little bit like Philip was imposing some structure to compose its composition. And that's sort of a natural setting to give more structure to your process, like convex structure or something like that. This is beautiful that you can do a lot of stuff graphically, like ultimately you're not going to write a whole physics down like in these two-dimensional pictures. You can do a lot. You can do a surprising amount there and simplifies yourself a lot. Even if you want to, like we say, you're doing examples in measurement-based quantum computing, but even if you do measurement-based quantum computing, then your cluster state has to be two-dimensional already. So you need already three dimensions to represent your cluster state together with your temporal dimension, which you can actually, if you're a very good drawer, then you can depict it. If you've got guys in your group, you can paint the program, and you can make them do this and the computer do this. What I do.
Okay, so let's start with Robert.